Welcome in, Hardhead hockey fans. We hope you all had a great, hardworking week across the country. What a week it has been. Live entertainment, must-watch television for this first round of playoff matchups. We hope you're here able to join us. We got another great slate of games today on this Saturday. Canes are taking on the Isles in Game 4. Panthers are at the Bolts. Bruins are at the Leafs. Stars are at Vegas. And I'm here, obviously, with my great friend and co-host for Hardhead Hockey, Grant Miller. How you doing?
Living large, Trent. We've had a full week of NHL playoff hockey. Some of it's been really great. Some of it's been, we'll be honest, tough to watch at times. I can't imagine what you're going through. Your team absolutely involved in this. The highs and lows of NHL hockey in these games are not for the faint of heart. But I'm enjoying it, you know, outside observer, guy that loves hockey. We got some good matchups and some matchups that we kind of knew what they were going to look like and aren't really surprised by. And we'll get all into that. But there's still a lot of meat left on the bone in some of these series. So I'm looking forward to getting into it with you, man.
It's been volatile. And like you said, definitely not for the faint of heart. And if you're a fan of the team, it can be the best of time. It can be the worst of times. Something like that, I think Charles Dickens said. So we've got a great show for you today. We're going to be talking about all the series that are going on in the East and the West. We're going to be talking about a little bit of NHL housekeeping, what's going on throughout the league outside of the NHL playoff matchups. We're going to be talking about a little fan mail that we received over this past week after episode 2. Appreciate our fans. And speaking of fans, we want to hear from you. You can contact us now currently at hardhathockey1@gmail.com. That's the words hardhathockey and the number one. Or you can follow us and leave a review for Hardhat Hockey Podcast on Spotify, YouTube, Samsung, Amazon. And this week we'll be coming out on Facebook and Instagram. So look for us there. Reach out. Let us know what you want to hear, how we can tailor our show for you, the Hardhat Hockey fans. We'll be giving shout outs to those who reach out all playoffs long, and we look forward to hearing from you. So without further ado, let's get this going. NHL housekeeping. Lindy Ruff was rehired at the Buffalo Sabres, according to ABC Sports. Ruff is 64, replaces Dan Granato, whom the Sabres fired after 3 seasons. Ruff coached the Sabres for 15 seasons from 1997 to 2013. The Sabres have not been to the playoffs since Lindy Ruff took them there in 2011. Thoughts?
I think this is a good move. The Sabres, I mean, it's like clockwork. Like, they start hot, fall off. Is this the year? It's a great market for hockey. They love their Sabres up there. I think he can try to get this ship in the right direction. Games changed a bit since he was last there, obviously. It didn't go terribly well in Jersey, but maybe this is a guy that can kind of tap into what they got. This year really was. I've for the past like 8 years, I told myself, like, I'm not going to believe that the Sabres are going to do it until they do it. But this year I kind of was like, wait a second, this feels different. No, it's not. They're going to trip over themselves, you know, eventually and not able to pull through. So, you know, good luck to Lindy, and hopefully the fine folks at Buffalo can experience playoff hockey, because that place is rocking when they're good.
Grant, I have a heavy dose of caution with this one. The performance in New Jersey was underwhelming, to say the least.
Certainly.
But Buffalo also had an underwhelming season as well, and this clearly is a good old boys move. He's got connections there, clearly, with the rehire and a good situation that he's walking into as well. They've got a stacked young blue line to include Owen Power and
it's all there.
Yeah,
it's all there for the taking. Yeah,
Tage Thompson is somebody that could explode at a moment's notice. I think he just needs to get the right spark. So
I'm a big Tage fan. I'm buying stock in Tage.
100%.
I might be too late on buying that. But he's one of those guys that, you know, every market, every team, every city should have just like a kid like that. And it makes watching the games so much more exciting.
San Jose Sharks fired David Quinn. David Quinn coached for 2 seasons, before then 3 seasons with the New York Rangers. Had a stint with the Colorado Avalanche as an assistant way back when. Fun fact, I actually saw him when he was the head coach of Boston University, and they came out for a series against the Denver Pioneers. So clearly experienced coaching career throughout multiple different leagues at the minor, college, and professional level. Sharks, no expectations to do well this year, but clearly I don't think they expected it to go this bad. What do you think about the move?
Former Lake Erie Monsters coach. So, yeah, I'm quite familiar with him as the head coach for the Jackets affiliate. I think he'll probably get another shot. You're right. It didn't go well. They didn't have, terribly high expectations. It's kind of one of those things that you just, at a certain point, the coach has to kind of eat it. And for lack of a better term, so whether it's his fault or not, whether the rebuild's going a certain way, it's just sometimes it just doesn't work. And we see this a lot. We see this a lot where coaches just get, let go because they got to go in a different direction. And I think he'll probably land on his feet. From what I've heard, he's pretty organized, stand-up guy. He's just got to find the right organization to get in there with.
Funny story, when they came to town at DU with Boston University, Clayton Keller was on the team for the Terriers.
Oh, yeah. Where
I get a phone call at the ticket office from none other than Clayton Keller's grandfather looking for a ticket. Really nice guy. Was able to help him out. No, yeah. Mr. Kelly, if you're listening, great times back in the day. Reach out for Hard Hat Hockey. Hope you're a fan. All right. NHL draft lottery is set for 7 May. And I know this will hit near and dear to your heart. Grant, Sharks, 18.5% odds of getting that number one draft pick. To no one's surprise, Chicago Blackhawks are sitting in second at 13.5% odds. And I think there is some insidious jockeying of the numbers there, perhaps. Ducks, 11.5%. CBJ is 9.5%. Montreal Canadiens, 8.5%. And then I included it for the excitement of the new team, the Utah hockey team as it stands, the nameless Utah hockey team.
Utah to be determined.
The Utah to be determined, 7.5% chance of getting the number one draft pick. CBJ's obviously going to get a good player regardless in this draft.
Yeah. I still kind of have PTSD from last year a little bit, but it doesn't feel like this is as high stakes as last year's draft. Yeah, we'll be up there. We're in the mix. You don't want to be in the mix too much, but we have been drafting well the past couple of years. We've seemingly have picked talented players. It just doesn't seem like they're getting the option or the opportunity to develop with the squad. So I'm not as locked into this as I was last year. I think that's true for most teams. I think you kind of mentioned it. You can bump the Blackhawks probability up to about 50%, I would say. And then you can take that from the CBJ. I don't think there's a chance we'd get a top three. I don't think we're going to sneak in there. But it's part of the game. It's part when you lose a lot, you see your guys going to the – do you watch the lottery often, Trent?
I haven't in a long time. The last time it was –
it's so pitiful. They bring out, the GMs and the guys, and, they're like, yeah, tough year in Anaheim. And it's like, yeah, well, we're going to try to get a good – it's not like the draft where it's like, oh, the player's here, the family's having fun. It's like a very dour – experience.
It's a solemn time.
Yeah, and then when your number gets pulled where you are projected, you're projected to get fifth, and then your lottery number comes up fifth, you just have to shrug your shoulders that's what makes sense. And then one person is leaving the lottery happy. It's a weird thing that we televise. I mean they're going to keep televising. It's going to keep being news. We're talking about it, but it's such a weird — I almost think we should just do it. I don't know. I would love to work at a sports consulting firm and be like, let's rethink the lottery, not necessarily how it's organized and how the numbers work, but how it's presented. It should be, maybe you don't know the order until the day of the draft, and they do some big reveal or something. I don't know. I don't know. That would probably leak out, but just having John Davidson just trotted out there every year, just kind of shrugging his shoulders, having to pick third or fourth. It's such a downer.
To spark some optimism in you, in the 2017 draft class, the Avs were coming off effectively their worst year in franchise history. And at the time was the worst record in the NHL in the cap era. So one of the worst
teams. I remember it. I remember it fondly. Yeah.
It was bad. It was bad times. Dark times in Denver. Going to the 2017 draft, Avs had the highest chances for the number one draft pick, fell to number four, where Cale Makar landed in our lap. And I think everyone would agree at this point, he probably should have been taken in the first spot. So,
yeah, he had a great World Juniors tournament that year. You and I were on that. I remember talking with you right after that. I was like, dude, I think this is going to actually work out.
I see.
Because we were such big Cale Makar guys to begin with. But no, the Avs gave Cale a chance to like play and like make mistakes but get better. And then apparently, for whatever reason, the Jackets just, we don't do that with our young defensemen, where we send them to Cleveland on a day's notice and then they aren't able to get to Cleveland in time to actually suit up. So they don't even play and they're just stuck in between Columbus and Cleveland. And then, you know, it's not great. Our youth development needs reassessed, but that's a conversation for a different day.
A little retooling.
And moving forward, the World Championship roster this year features a bolstered lineup, probably the best of its kind that we've seen really since 2010, during when Zach Parise and Ryan Suter suited up in the World Championships. And this is often viewed as a audition, if you will, for the upcoming tournaments. Those tournaments being the Four Nations Tournament in 2025, which is the first of its kind in a sense. We've got United States, Canada, Sweden, and Finland all just going to face off in a Super Smash Brothers duke it out, winner takes all. And then we've obviously the Winter Olympics in Milan in 2026. So this is that time for players of all nations, but USA Hockey specifically, for players to not only participate in these tournaments that they may not normally participate, but show out. We've got the roster includes Dylan Larkin, Matt Boldy from Minnesota, Cole Caulfield, Johnny Gaudreau that you know and love, Brady Tkachuk, Trevor Zegras from the Ducks, Luke Hughes, and Zach Werenski to name a few. Look for a lot of these guys to make those final rosters. Thoughts?
Two Jackets on there, man. Yeah, Zach had a great year. I'm happy to see him get rewarded within like a pretty rough full team season. He was really a shining star. Came back from a tough injury last year. Just signed that big ticket two off seasons ago. So, you know, good to see him like continually progress even after getting the big payday. Boudreaux's still really talented. It's still, I think he's going to get it figured out. It's been a past tough couple years here in Columbus, which is a shame, but he's, you put him on the ice with a lot of these talented guys. I think hopefully the rest of the country kind of sees that he's still the man.
So, something that we're going to do in the off season, we're going to commit a whole episode to USA Hockey projections and where we think the roster is going to go. After the World Championships, we're going to have a better idea, obviously, who performs and who catches the eye of those coaches, because there are big time decisions to make. And this is we're now in that window of time, and it's the first time in a while that NHL players are going to be able to represent their country on an international stage. And I know that's got to
feel great again. It feels great.
Well, and think about it too. There's guys like Austin Matthews who frankly have not had that opportunity.
Oh, we've missed so many, like the window for some of these guys to like have their moment internationally, which they all love. They all want to like represent their country. Just the business side and the federation side just hasn't been able to like figure that out, which is, it's a travesty. I mean, we haven't seen, it's been like 10 years. It's been 10 years since we've seen real competitive top end talent play against each other. So no, it feels good. I'm excited. A little cheat code for any of you fans out there whose teams aren't in the playoffs. This is a fun thing to like really care about. And, you know, you see your guys go play for like their country, or like you get into like the USA, you're like, yeah, still got that itch. And like, you want to see like your young guy who's like from, you know, Sweden, like ball out. And you're like, oh yeah, he's locked in. He's not going to lose a step next year. He's actually going to improve over the off season. You can really talk yourself into that. Speaking from experience there a little bit.
Yeah, and the draft as well. Another great time to just garner up some excitement if you miss the playoffs. So not all hope is lost, fans. Speaking of sparking hope in dark places, obviously we had a lot of coverage about the team moving from the Arizona Coyotes now to the nameless, to be determined mascot
in Salt Lake City. Over this past week, the players were introduced in a press conference slash fan introduction type event to spark some excitement in the area at the Delta Center. All the players introduced themselves. Crowd went crazy with Clayton Keller when he introduced himself. Probably going to be one of the leadership focuses moving forward for that organization. Liam O'Brien definitely captured some hearts. Don't understand the nickname as much, but he told the crowd, "You can call me Spicy Tuna," and they loved it. They ate it up. Trademarks were filed for 8 different Utah hockey names, and since then, it's exploded on social media, a lot of different inputs, and I'm going to list the names here and just tell me what you think. We've got the Utah Ice, the Utah Yetis, the Utah Venom, Utah Fury, Utah Blizzard, Utah Outlaws, Utah Mammoth, or the Utah Hockey Club. Interesting take that they didn't stick with just Salt Lake City and went straight for the whole state representation in Utah. I like the Mammoth.
First off, let me go back to the Liam O'Brien thing. Knowing hockey guys the way we do, like, it was probably like he got like a spicy tuna roll, like sushi, like out with the guys one night, and they were just like, "Oh, the fucking spicy tuna over here." That's definitely just like how that like stuck, and then maybe he got like a goal the next game or something silly. But the names, I like Yetis. A lot of these just seem like old school, like arena football nicknames. I'm not impressed with some of these. I hope they don't do hockey club. I kind of, as a big soccer fan, especially here in America, like every expansion team is now just called like, you know, Charlotte FC, Atlanta United. There's no like actual character to the names. So if they go that way, it's such a cop out. The owner for this new Utah franchise does own the MLS team in Salt Lake, and their name's Real Salt Lake, as in Real Madrid. He inherited that name though from the previous ownership. But it is interesting. You said they do the Utah naming. They want to cover the whole state when you have that big of a footprint out west. They don't want to limit themselves, which I think is kind of counterintuitive, honestly. But we'll see. As far as states names, Utah, pretty good. That's a strong name. It's easy, rolls off the tongue, 4 letters. You know, Salt Lake, it's a little tough sometimes to say.
Your abs
aren't called the Denver Avalanche though.
Right. Definitely some extra syllables. I think they made a right call with the Utah
date. Grant, this past week, we did have some fans reach out to our HardHatHockey1 Gmail account. If you want to reach out to us in the future, let us know what you think about the show. Again, HardHatHockey1@gmail.com. Expanding to social media this coming week, so look out for that. Big times here at Hard Hat Hockey. We had Chet Carson from Snake River, Washington, in response to our question about what you would do on a breakaway and how you would score against an NHL goalie. Grant, Chip Carson would pull the puck wide left, cross to the right while coming in front of the goalie, then deke right again, then deke left again, then execute a full 360 before going top shelf, and then double fist pump, thumbs to the chest as to tell everyone how great he is. So Chet, I love the confidence. I can see it in my head playing out. And I hope you get the opportunity to execute that flawless.
Yeah, Chet sounds like he tore it up in juniors back in the day or something with all those skills. My God.
Chet has the swagger we're looking for here at Hard Hat Hockey. And then we had Dina from Tampa Bay, big time Lightning fan, wanted to understand a little bit more about the history and the purpose of Florida Panthers throwing rats onto the ice. I'm sure as a Lightning fan, you do not appreciate rats being tossed onto the ice at your players in a 7-game series. So here we go. In 1995, Captain Scott Mellenby, before a game, they were playing against the Calgary Flames, killed a rat in the pregame. That night, he went on to score 2 goals, and it would become known as the rat trick. And pretty much from then on, a tradition was born. And throughout the years, rats would be thrown on, similar to the octopus in Detroit Red Wings or the catfish with the Nashville Predators. The rats would be thrown in the middle of the game, so much so that Marty Brodeur in a series against the Devils one year complained about it, and the Florida Panthers respectfully asked their fans to stop throwing rats on the ice mid-game and to preserve it for the end of the game. So
fun facts. That's such a trash Florida tradition. Like, we live in this swamp infested state. There's just rats everywhere. Throw them on the ice. And shout out to the Panthers for being like, okay, listen, I know we can't stop you from doing this. Just please respect the flow of the game. You idiots are going to do it. Do it after the final whistle. That's what's crazy about that story is like 1995. Like, this is before social media. Like, some beat reporter from the newspaper had to like get that story and publish it. So shout out to local journalism. That's why it's important to get those behind the scenes looks. And I, you know, I'm hating on this, but it seems like it's, you know, good fun. It's just fucking, that's so disgusting. Even if they're plastic, it's just like, come on. People think Florida's like a paradise. Like, I know the Panthers for a while had that logo where it's like a palm tree and like a sun. It's like, no, it's a rat and it's just muggy weather and jean shorts. It's not paradise.
It just feels dirty. All right, Grant. Well, that's enough for housekeeping in the NHL across the league. Let's dive into the playoffs. What a week. In general sense, I know we were texting back and forth. The Eastern Conference has gone kind of as we predicted, a little easier to forecast. The outside of the Bruins-Leafs series, which has decidedly become a battle, and we'll get to that, obviously. The Western Conference had some unexpected games, I would say, and has definitely been much more contentious. Maybe not in the compete level, but in the results. We've got some tight series, so we'll get right into it. Florida Panthers against the Lightning. The Panthers are up 3-0 in the series, and they play today at 5 Eastern at this time of recording. The Panthers have allowed 7 goals in 3 games, and something that we spoke to in the second episode of Hard Hat Hockey History would be the difference of the blue lines, or the blue line depth, if you will. You got Montour, Forsling, Aaron Ekblad, and Mikkola stepping up. 7 goals in 3 games is an absurd goals against average. And some of that experience has really shined through. Game 3, Victor Hedman dressed for his 163rd playoff game. The next 5 defensemen on the Tampa Bay Lightning had a combined 149 playoff games of experience. So there you see a stark contrast in the Tampa Bay Lightning depth that even a few years ago has clearly taken some hits with the Stanley Cup tax, is what I like to call it. The Panthers currently have the playoff league leading 28.6% conversion rate on the power play. And the Lightning has dropped to 16%, which is not going to be enough to cut it, especially when you're hard enough to find goals. You need your special teams to come through. Yeah. Is this series over?
I will refrain from pouring dirt onto the Lightning's coffin until they're actually dead, because I don't want to get ahead of these guys. But you said it. You said it there. It's a Stanley Cup tax. It's hard to keep good teams together in the NHL these days. So I thought that stat with Hedman was very telling. The Panthers just look locked in. They're firing on all cylinders. By the time this is posted, it might be over. You know, middleman Grant here. Like, I don't want to say it's over, but I'm impressed by the Panthers. And if they just stay locked in, don't give Lightning any air, it's over. Maybe we could put the Lightning to bed. But this is kind of the playing out how we thought. Kind of Panthers are just stacked, man. They're just well built.
If there is a team that can carve themselves out of 3-0, I do think the Tampa Bay Lightning would be one of them, as unlikely as it is to happen. If they're going to do it, they're going to need that power play to step up from the measly 16%. And directly correlated, they're going to need Nikita Kucherov to have a bigger effect. He had the Hart Trophy worthy performance all season long, and has kind of been a shadow of that performance in this first round. And that's don't want to take away any credit from the Florida Panthers. I mean, they've shown their depth.
They're a tough team to play against. I mean, that's how you can kind of limit a guy like that. The playoffs are weird because you kind of do sometimes need a game to get going, but you don't really have a game to get going. It's got to kind of happen as soon as you get on the ice, and good teams are able to just lock it in immediately. So, I mean, 3-0 is tough.
Hard Hat Hockey initially called the Florida Panthers in 7 games. The verdict, likely over, but maybe not. You never know.
Boston Bruins, Toronto Maple Leafs. The Boston Bruins are up 2-1 and one of the more confusing and definitely historic rivalries that we're seeing start to brew. Game 4 in Toronto today at 8 o'clock Eastern. For those of you who are going to be tuning in, the Bruins are converting on the power play at a 50% clip, averaging 2 goals against per game played, and being on the heroics of Jeremy Swayman, who is 2-0. The one loss came when they played Linus Ullmark. Jeremy leads the way of all goaltenders in the playoffs with a 1.51 goals against average. That game 3 certainly saw some antics on and off the ice. You could see the chippiness come to a new level. Ryan Reeves was blowing some people up. Marchand and Bertuzzi can't get out of each other's chili. Sheldon Keefe speaks about it after the game, calling Marshy elite at what he does. Some people took that as a dig and kind of bush league. Other people took it as simply a compliment to Brad Marchand. I'm sure if you're Boston Bruins fans, all you care about is just being up 2-1 in the series. And then we had the Willie Nylander interview, Grant. This very confusing and cryptic situation since the beginning of the playoffs. Willie Nylander played 82 games in the regular season and then has disappeared for the first 3 games of the playoffs. Some have said he had migraines, but he has been a full participant in practice. Some have spoken to a potential concussion being in the concussion protocol. Others think that this could be a under-the-table Sheldon Keefe disciplinary action. If you watch the interview, it's perplexing. He seems to have a little bit of an edge and seems frustrated that he's not playing, and frankly gives a little bit of an attitude to the reporters. So,
yeah, this is always a little concerning when guys just are unexplained absences like this. You really hope there's not like a serious injury here. We do see this sometimes in the NHL, and that's why, because he's still like a young kid who's got a lot to give the game. So I hope he's like okay. Like I hope it's not something that a doctor is like, no, you can't do it. But then like maybe he wouldn't be practicing, but maybe you can like just do light skates and that's not an issue. I don't know. I don't know what to make of this. NHL is obviously like hockey in general is very like protective of giving out the medical info. I mean, we always make the jokes like, oh, it's a upper body injury. It's like, well, that could be anything. And then, you know, guys play hurt through the playoffs and they just don't report it. So I don't know. I mean, it's kind of started. It's in my mind, but like how I kind of view this is almost overshadowing the game because I hope he's all right. But yeah, we're getting some classic Bruins Leafs shenanigans here. I'm hoping the Leafs win tonight to just get it to 2 games so we can lock in for like a best of 3, but it's kind of flowing how you expect. I mean, the Bruins just seem better, but the Leafs got one in game 2, man. They righted the ship, which I didn't think they would. I saw like a tweet. They had like an optional skate after game 1, and I don't want to read too much into this, but it was just funny internet content. Like 5 of the guys showed up for the optional skate. It's like, oh yeah, that feels very Leafs to me, but I won't be able to tune in tonight. I got plans tonight, but I will be trying to find like a rewatch or some capability to watch in the morning. Cause I am, this is the one I'm watching probably the most intently at this point. I want to see some good hockey.
I agree that we'll close it here. The Willie Nylander situation has been a distraction. Frankly, I think if Toronto's going to come back and win the series, they're going to need him in the lineup. So we'll see how that plays out. It's got to be taking a toll in the locker room. I can't imagine that this is just something that guys are able to just move on from, having played with a bona fide NHL All-Star for 82 games in the regular season. If the Boston Bruins continue to win, to do so, they're going to need to continue to lean on Jeremy Swayman. I know they did the goaltender rotation throughout the season. Credit to Jimmy Montgomery for being able to balance his goaltenders like that. I think you are seeing, ride the hot hand. Swayman will get you this series. He'll win it. Hardhat Hockey called Bruins in 7. Verdict, is the series over? I'm saying absolutely not. We've got ourselves a battle here. Buckle up. We're in for the long haul. Carolina Hurricanes, New York Islanders. The Canes are up 3-0 in a what would some consider a predictable series. To me, this one, if I'm an Islanders fan, I'm kicking myself. Game four today at Long Island, 2 o'clock Eastern. Kind of a heartbreaking scene at the end of last game, or middle of last game, rather. Ilya Sorokin was pulled, letting in 3 goals on 8 shots. Big team guy, hanging his head in the hallway, and they just kept showing him on national television. And you could see just how hurt he was. I mean, he spoke to it after the game. I love how selfless he is, and just hate to see, you know, just the emotion of the playoffs come through. In game two, the Hurricanes were down 3 goals, came back, scored 2 goals at the end in 9 seconds to take the lead and win that game. Another opportunity if you're an Islanders fan that you should have had that one. The Canes were outshot in game one, 34-26, and were still able to steal the game. They're also leaning heavily on some goaltending. Frederik Andersen, .922 save percentage. Canes have sported 11 goals for and 6 goals against. So this, on paper, looks like a goaltender difference, but I think the real key here is the Islanders just aren't scoring, and they need their big guys like Brock Nelson, Bo Horvat, Anders Lee. They need them to step up. You got a lot of veteran experience here, and I think that's what's plagued the Islanders for a long time, Grant.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, we kind of called this one, man. The Canes are just a machine. I mean, I this is the last team I want to play in the playoffs, just the way they play. They're putting up 100 shots to the Islanders, like 10. And they can't do it. And Anderson's having a great series. So, yeah, he's keeping the Islanders off the scoreboard. And it's so demoralizing when you do get, like, a good chance and Anderson makes just an acrobatic save. And, you know, you fought so hard just to create that chance. And now you got to go back to the other end of the ice and withstand a 20-shot barrage from just these, like, nameless, faceless Canes that are just rolling lines. Everyone's just weighing down on you. It's awful. I don't envy the Islanders. So, yeah, I think this is – I will say I think this is over. I mean, the Islanders have shown their ability to kind of hang in these games, but they just – the Canes wear you out. It's just – you can't breathe. So I don't know. I don't even know how I would feel as a Canes fan if this was like the style of play. I don't know. There's no romance in this. I don't know how I feel. Every time I watch the Canes, I'm just like, I couldn't imagine living in Raleigh and just turning like hockey into a math equation.
Well, Raleigh's a great town. I like Raleigh a lot.
Sure it is. I'm sure.
To your point, the Canes haven't exactly exhibited to me that they're going to be dominant moving forward. I think the Islanders have been able to create some opportunities. They just haven't been opportunistic. And then into your description of the Carolina Hurricanes having these faceless, nameless players, it's Rob Brind'Amour's soldiers, man. He's got his army tuned up.
He's the star.
And they operate like a fleet of soldiers. So is it over? Hard at Hockey called this one Canes in 5. Verdict, yeah, it's over. Madison Square Garden. New York Rangers, blue shirts, President Trophy winner are up 3-0 on the Capitals. This has probably been the most predictable matchup. They're just outclassed, man. 11 goals for the Rangers, 5 goals against. They can't even lean on Ovechkin at this point. There's been a lot of kind of interesting quotes from head coach Carberry about Ovechkin. Quote, he should get 4 or 5 looks on a nightly basis. He's not getting those looks. I know Carberry commented on Ovechkin's effort the other night during an empty net goal. I don't think there's much to discuss here. I think this one is over, and I'm looking for a sweep on Sunday at 8 p.m. Eastern.
Yeah, I'm with you. I know I flirted with the idea of the Caps, played spoiler here. So my bad on that. I think I did a decent job of hedging my understanding of what I was expecting from the Caps. They're not good. They haven't been good. With the Ovi thing, though, like, are you, like, this is kind of who Ovi is. Like, I don't know. Like, even, yeah, I'm not saying he doesn't work hard. Like, he put this team on his back and they won a cup. That is something, like, I've never experienced. If you're a Caps fan, I think you take that deal every day, twice on Sundays. Like, you have Ovi, you have your moments. He gets you one cup, but the end is going to be kind of, you know, record chasing. He's not going to put in a lot of work, but even when he was at his best, he wasn't putting in like a ton of the work. He's hanging out in his office and putting the pucks in the net, and it's great when it works, but I don't know. Like, are you surprised? Like, if you're a Caps fan, like, you can't be surprised by this. Like, you can't be frustrated. So, but I mean, you probably are. It's easy for me to say that. But yeah, this is over, dude. This was over game one. It's never been more over.
I'm really interested to see what the Caps do in the offseason. I foresee a big trade coming, perhaps in the likes of a John Carlson or maybe even a TJ Oshie. I don't know. We'll see. Before we move out, Wes Grant, message for our fans, Hard Hat Hockey fans, we want to hear from you. Contact us currently at hardhathockey1@gmail.com. Find us on the apps. However you listen to your weekly hockey podcast, Spotify, YouTube, Amazon, leave us a comment, reach out, let us know what you want to hear and how we can tailor our show for you, the Hard Hat Hockey fans. Let's go out west, Grant. Fly with me now. Vancouver Canucks versus the Nashville Predators. The upset that I predicted of the Preds in seven. Preds losing effectively a heartbreaker last night in what was their best performance, but couldn't sustain it in their first home game on Broadway. Game four will be at Bridgestone Arena, 5:00 Eastern on Sunday. The Preds will look to tie that. A couple stats jumped out to me. Shots per game played. The Preds have effectively put 24 average shots on that versus the Canucks 17, which speaks to Nashville's lockdown defense. And UC Saros playing okay. They stole one in Vancouver in game two. The Canucks were able to win game three with 12 shots on goal. The Nashville Predators gave up two power play goals after they had 100% penalty kill up to that point in the series. So obviously a backbreaker at home. Would have loved to see the Preds take advantage of that. Again, speaking about being opportunistic in the playoffs, that one's going to sting as we get deeper into this series that I think is going to go the distance of that seven games. It's been a defensive battle. Thatcher Demko injured after game one. Casey DeSmith stepped in for the next two games and has played well. Saros could be a little bit better, currently sporting a .880 save percentage, but also in that game two steal in Vancouver that we talked about, he was peppered. So it's kind of been, each game has had its own wildly polarizing narrative, and what we've kind of seen is the team who's playing better gets robbed. And then last quote I'll leave you with here, the mayor of Vancouver in regards to why they don't have outdoor watch parties for the fan base, and I know you're going to have fun with this one. And I quote, "We have to be incredibly responsible and thoughtful. We have a history of 1994 and 2011, obviously referring to Vancouver's riots throughout the city during their last notable losses in Stanley Cup playoff runs. People, behave. And we can watch games outside."
Maybe. I mean, I don't know. It seems like the mayor's got his mind made up here. I don't think the five folks in Vancouver can do anything to convince this guy to change his mind. It's round one. It's like no one's rioting after round one.
Oh, I bet they would if they lose.
No, dude, it's 20. We're so far past. I don't say we're so far past, but like everyone's just like on their phones, like, you know, just on TikTok anyway. Like I don't think you're looking at what 94 or even 11. 2011 happened because it was like the cup. I don't know. That was kind of a wild thing to be like, you're so defensive so early. Because I remember when like the Olympics were out there, dude. It was like Mardi Gras. It was a party every night.
Yeah, 2010.
Yeah, and you think of like, I know Canada is a wide ranging country. It's huge. There's cultural differences between all the major cities. I'm not trying to lump in these two cities. I'm simply stating the fact that hockey is such a community event and grips the imagination of these cities. I think of when the Leafs are like the outdoor watch parties for the Leafs are always like packed and you see them on Twitter and stuff. And it's amazing to watch. I imagine Vancouver would have a similar set up, but apparently not. Apparently they're just watching in like bars and your buddy's basement or whatever. So I don't know if the Canucks blow this, I'm blaming the mayor because he just, you know, doesn't want anyone to have a good time. They'll hopefully they won't regret that game too much because that was tough. That was brutal to witness. But I'm still rocking with the Canucks. I like this team. I you know, I say kind of what I said about the Preds. We'll maybe we save that for the next episode if this series keeps going. But yeah, give me the Canucks. Give me Quinn Hughes.
Verdict here at Hard Hat Hockey, is this series over? Not even close. And to respond to your rioting conversation, I think if the Preds upset them, I think you're going to see a riot. But we'll see. We'll see. Edmonton Oilers versus the Los Angeles Kings. Edmonton Oilers are showing their offensive class, especially in Game 3. They're up 2-1 in the series. Oilers are at the Kings, 10:30 Eastern on Sunday. They have a 5.67 goals per game in the playoffs thus far for the first three games. That's tied for first. 50% conversion rate on the power play and 100% on the PK. Special teams have stepped up in a big way, and they're engineering a colossal rate, 39 shots per game. Kings were able to steal one in Edmonton.
Went to OT.
Went to OT. Yeah, definitely saw some late game heroics. Any shot for the LA Kings to come back and win the series for me is going to come down to improve special teams. One small bright spot for the Kings, Quentin Byfield, a little bit of a coming out party. He's got a +5, which leads the playoffs right now in the NHL for +/-. So love to see that two-way game.
He's good. Yeah. He's really good. So I don't know. Give me the Oilers. Give me the Oilers for the sake of the rest of the playoffs to keep watching them, because they're so fun to watch.
What's impressive about Byfield's +5, though, and something that they can definitely lean on moving forward, is the Edmonton Oilers have scored 17 goals in three games. So 17 goals against, and he's still able to put out a +5. That's impressive. That's great. He's playing great.
Yeah, I'm not a big +/- guy, but when you see anomalies like that, it is very telling. So I don't know. Keep him on the ice.
Is this one over?
No, I don't think it is. It's because the Knights are just so annoying. Or not the Knights, excuse me, the Kings are so annoying. But if the Oilers win Sunday night, I'll be singing a different tune. But we don't know yet, so probably tune into that. Or I'm going to try. I'll fall asleep. I won't make it all the way. But, you know, if you're an Oilers fan, you know, you've been burned so many times, you're not letting your guard down.
100%. You like what you see, but that losing that one at home probably stung. Moving on, Dallas Stars versus the Vegas Golden Knights. This has been the most shocking to me in the worst kind of way. The Knights are up 2-0 in the series. Dallas Stars are at Vegas, 10:30 Eastern tonight, to try to get back in this series. They're going to have to steal some games on the road in a hostile Vegas environment. We've all seen that arena and their Vegas showmanship that they crank up.
They crank it up to 100
for the playoffs, man. They remember that first year, you've got some knight skating around on the ice, fighting a rat, you know.
Like 30 minutes before the puck drop.
It's a whole Broadway production. Oh, the Vegas Golden Knights are averaging 20 shots on goal per game. The difference here has been the visible lockdown defense. Even on TV, you can see there is no room on the ice for the Dallas Stars. The top six forwards for Dallas have not been able to produce at the clip that they were in the regular season. Joe Pavelski, Sagan, Duchesne, Rupe Hintz have been nearly irrelevant, and I think that speaks to the talent and the defensive game that the Vegas Golden Knights are able to produce on every single line that they roll out there. Jake Oettinger hasn't been great. 3.1 goals against average, .850 save percentage, and 0-2 versus Logan Thompson's .920 save percentage. The difference here is the Dallas Stars can't create chances, and that is going to need to change on the road in a hostile environment. What do you think?
Yeah, it's not going to be easy. When your stars aren't producing in the playoffs, you kind of question reality, because you're just like, what's the point? What's the point of having Sagan and Duchesne if this isn't working? So I've been there. I get how awful that feels. Yeah, man, I think that this is the Knights. This is kind of what we've grown accustomed to, where it's just four really solid lines. It's, you know, kind of not to the point of like Carolina, but it is suffocating, and they're going to keep this going. I don't know. I hope not. I hope the Stars can make this a series because the Stars are really fun to watch when they're firing, but they're not firing right now.
I hope not too. And if you're a Dallas Stars fan, you're concerned because you've been sitting on this Tyler Seguin and Jamie Benn core, Joe Pavelski for a long time. And you've been floating in and out of your cup chances. And this seemed like the year, and you really hope they can find that spark in a bottle again. Come on, Stars, fire it up.
If the Stars weren't playing the Knights, like, they would be kind of hateable. Like, they're kind of a hateable team.
I can see that.
Because they're the play of the Knights, I think, like, collectively, a lot of people are like, come on, guys. Come on, let's do it.
Moving on. So, series over, verdict. I really hope not. Moving on to the series that some people have called drunk, and this will be our last series analysis, a very volatile, explosive, high-flying matchup that has been the Colorado Avalanche versus the Winnipeg Jets. Avs were able to go up in the series last night with a 6-2 win. They were down 2-1 going into the third and then exploded in an offensive juggernaut performance for their first game in Denver, which was great to see. They played game 4 Sunday at 2:30 in Denver. The big question mark was goaltending in game 1. Alexander Georgiev let up 7 in game 1 and then proceeded to let up 2 in game 2 and two goals in game 3. A lot of people wondered if we were going to roll with Justus Annanen moving forward for the rest of the series. Jared Bednar stuck with Alexander Georgiev. Part reason maybe because Justus was sick, but I digress. Alexander Georgiev has definitely turned the tides for now. Hopefully he can keep it rolling. Hellebuck is currently sporting a 5.05 goals against average. If the Jets have any chance, they're going to need a lot better performance from him. Going to be difficult to do with the Avalanche averaging 39 shots on goal. So definitely getting their looks. Mittelstadt, Lehkonen, Girard, Manson are all top 25 in the playoffs right now in plus minus. I know that you don't like this stat, but to me it is telling that the Avs have 4 players in the top 25 and the Jets don't have 1.
They're putting the puck in the net. They're getting goals. Yeah, I mean, we're rooting for the Avs for the sake of this podcast and the vibes. But, I don't think the Jets are dead by any means. I think when you have a goalie who's shown you his ability to kind of carry the team, you know, that 6-2 win you mentioned, a little misleading because, like, the Jets were in that the whole way. And it was kind of an explosion, which sometimes when it rains, it pours. So if you're the Jets, you throw the tape out on that. You say, hey, let's not let that get us bogged down. Sometimes it's almost better in the playoffs to get like blown out because you can just kind of write it off as opposed to like losing in like an excruciating game in OT or something. Like it's hard to get over that. So we'll see what happens, man. This is the most fun series to watch without question. You think the Avs kind of have this, but just the way the Jets play, man, you can't get past it.
Whoever comes out of this series is going to be feeling good about their chances because both teams I think are of very high quality and it's a tough matchup. And kind of what we spoke to at the beginning of the episode, the playoffs aren't good for your heart if it's your team on the ice. And unfortunately, this series is not over. I think this one goes longer than 5. I don't think the Avs are going to win out by any means. I think this series is going to go deep, and it's going to be even harder on my heart. So, but credit to the Winnipeg Jets. They're a very good team, and they're hard to beat. They're hard to play against right now. So, Grant, that's our playoff matchup analysis. Moving forward, we have a very special treat. First of its kind, the Hard Hat Hockey was able to sit down with longtime legacy of Boston hockey community and Northeastern University hockey alumni Matt Connolly. Really looking forward to Hard Hat Hockey fans' feedback about this interview. A lot of insights with a great man and a great hockey family that has reaches across the country. So tune into that. Before we get to the interview, this Hard Hat Hockey interview is sponsored by Leroy's Bar. Located in the heart of Worcester, Ohio, Leroy's establishment has provided cheap pitchers and a safe haven for blue-collar workers alike since 1969. Leroy's can be your hockey home for all the NHL playoff action. Drink responsibly and drive safe. Okay, Hard Hat Hockey fans, host Trenton Dunn here with Matt Connolly in Hard Hat Hockey's first ever interview, and I'm thrilled to introduce Matt to the Hard Hat Hockey community because of the wealth of knowledge, the humility, and the credibility that he brings to not just the game of hockey, but everything that he's done in life. He's a
alumni from Northeastern Hockey University in the Boston area and comes from a long storied, rich tradition of hockey players in the Boston community. In this interview, we're going to look into youth hockey in Boston, college hockey, how that's transcended into the USA hockey program that we've seen today, and then the farther reaches of Matt's connections into the NHL arenas and beyond. So without further ado, I'm honored to introduce Matt Connolly. Matt.
Trent, thank you for having me, and I love what you guys are doing with this podcast. It really hits the mark for me and represents hockey well.
Thanks, Matt. So we've got a chance to talk a little bit before this interview. Obviously, with hockey, the Northeastern community, something I've noticed about Boston as a whole is you have how many D1 programs within a football throw of each other in the Boston area?
Well, that's great, Trent. You're right. Not too many people, you know, understand the concentration of college hockey talent in Boston, and that's really celebrated throughout the year, but certainly once a year. It's the first two Mondays in February, which is the Beanpot Hockey Tournament, which I believe started in 1952, but it's the four Boston colleges that have Division I programs. And that's Boston College, Chestnut Hill, Boston University, and Northeastern, which are literally a driver, you know, my driver, which is not long, as far apart. And then across the river in Cambridge, Mass, Harvard University, those four teams get together in a round robin tournament the first two Mondays of February. And it's such a terrific tradition that brings together the community and really is a Boston thing, because Boston's a very, you know, tribal and old school town, and, you know, families go back a long way and loyalties are always kept sacred, and it's where the alumni bases for those four schools are galvanized. Now, outside of Boston, I want to give respect to, you know, UMass Lowell, UMass Amherst, UMaine, UNH, you know, Providence, and forgive me for leaving out any schools, but, you know, it really is such a great diaspora college Division I hockey talent. And then throw in Quinnipiac, next state over in Connecticut.
and even beyond the D1 level, I mean, schools like Bentley, I believe, are Division III hockey schools that we haven't even mentioned, just talking to the density of hockey as a whole in the area.
Wow. Yeah, well, yeah, that's a great follow-up, because, you know, the NESCAC conference, which is Division III, is really strong. They're the Bowdens, the Babsons, the Williams, where my brother played, and just terrific hockey. Bentley, you know, believe it or not, is Division I, and, you know, they're not in the powerhouse of Hockey East with those other schools, but it really is remarkable. And you throw in, there's a Division II cluster in there that's not a lot of schools, but they're, you know, strong programs that scrap and play a high degree of hockey. And my godson played for Assumption College, and my nephew, his brother, also played there too. They were the Assumption College Greyhounds, and they you know, strong program, right there in a small vicinity.
Absolutely. We're talking to the tradition and the heritage of hockey in the Boston area. Obviously, the density of the sport comes from somewhere. I had the distinct privilege of reading the article you sent me from 1949 regarding your father's athletic prowess at Northeastern University. Can you just speak to his legacy a little bit, and then we'll tie that into just the explosion of hockey in the Boston area, kind of where those ties come from?
Great. Well, thank you, Trent. Yeah, my dad is a proud veteran, and, you know, he served at the end of the World War II and in the Pacific Theater, and, you know, and thankfully due to the GI Bill, he went to Northeastern, and going to Northeastern, he was a three sport athlete, which is certainly, you know, not possible today, but it was very unique then as well, where he played football in the fall, hockey in the winter, baseball in the spring, and excelled in all three. And, you know, he, you know, made an impact in a lot of people's lives with being a coach at Northeastern baseball, being involved with clinics, being a backfields coach, being, you know, a skills coach in hockey, and then, you know, throw in officiating. My dad did a lot of officiating of high school hockey and college hockey in New England. And, you know, he really saw it develop.
Yeah. Wow. So your father, he introduced youth hockey to you. You know, how old were you when you first put on the skates?
I was the youngest of four. And so, yeah, I wanted to emulate my older brothers and sisters, and they were certainly active and into sports. So being the youngest of four, I was always trying to keep up. A lot of times I was probably thrown in the net for street hockey, we called it. Some people call it ball hockey, but we played street hockey all winter. Checks over the snowbanks. We were fortunate. We had a swamp behind us right next to the highway 128 that used to freeze up. We used to play pond hockey. Back then, the winters were colder, so there was a lot more pond hockey access. And also, we were able to walk to a rink. So I remember a lot of memories of getting dressed at home. I don't know why I did that, but the shin pads on, the hockey pants on, the cup on. And then put the bag over your shoulder, walk up, and you put your skates on and put your elbows and pads and shoulder pads on. And helmet, no cage, of course, back then, and take the ice. I was able to walk to a rink. But, you know, when it was late, you know, I get a lot of appreciation from my parents. Like anybody that's, you know, played this sport, you know, for a continued period of time, you know, great family support. I remember my mom, you know, taking me to, you know, practices when my dad was working, officiating hockey games during weeknights. And then my dad taking me early mornings on Saturday to Walter Brown Arena, which was BU's rink, which is where Greater Boston Hockey had their league. The games were played on Saturday, and it was a very good league.
I've heard that's one of the nicer arena rinks in the country.
Yeah, well, the new rink at Gannis Center, oh yeah, it is top notch. And Walter Brown Arena was a very nice rink for its time. This is going back, Trent, you know, 40 years ago now, you know, more than that, 45, 50 years. So Walter Brown was best in class in its day, but and that's where BU's hockey team played up until maybe 15 years ago. And then they moved into the Gannis Center, which is a phenomenal venue and, you know, reflective of the Blue Bird program that BU is, you know, with a lot of national championships, not as many as your Pios, TD, but a lot of national championships and Olympians, Jack O'Callaghan, Davey Silk, Mike Ruzioni, just a great program. And also my better half went undergrad there. She's a Terrier, but ironically enough, she went to grad school at BC and got her MBA at the Carroll School. So, but she's more a Terrier when it comes to beanpot time. And we were fortunate we went there this year and saw BU beat BC and Northeastern beat Harvard and then Northeastern beat BU to win their second beanpot in a row. Incredible.
You know, before I get the thought, I vividly remember the Pee Wee hockey Mighty Man walk when your bag is twice your size and it's on your board. You're walking in with all your pads on. Yeah. But it's fun. So you mentioned even Mrs. Connolly, you know, being a fan of the Terriers, but also having this respect for Boston College. And something just in doing a little research I've noticed is there's a lot of family ties into not just the universities. I imagine this runs even deeper into the youth hockey communities. Because like we said beforehand, you're a football throw away from rink A to rink B. There has to be just long-term friendships there. Can you speak to just the Boston hockey community as a whole, kind of what that meant to you growing up and maybe how you've seen it transcend into your life today?
Yeah. You know, Trent, you know, Boston hockey's always been part of it, going back to the original 16 the Bruins were and you know, Boston Arena dating back to 1910. But it really exploded, and I was fortunate for that, in the early 1970s. That's when Bobby Orr, you know, from Perry Sound, Ontario, came to Boston to play for the Bruins. And Bobby Orr was such a unique, special, beautiful player to watch. You know, take it end to end effortlessly and just such a graceful player that kind of brought together power, figure skating, craze. And as a result of that, it kind of, captivated a region, New England, but certainly Massachusetts. And, part of that, that energy and that interest, the state invested in public hockey rinks. And they were MDC rinks, Metropolitan District Commission rinks, and they weren't fancy. They were Quonset House style with a roof over. Some were outdoors too, because back then the winters were colder, and that gave access to a lot more people the opportunity of hockey. And as we know, hockey's not an inexpensive sport, and so having public rinks where ice time was not cost prohibitive really made a big difference in the 70s, and that's what really galvanized Massachusetts, greater Boston area, Massachusetts, and New England around hockey. And that was brilliant, whoever had the courage to get that investment through to kind of provide access for hockey to people that love the sport from watching Bobby Orr. And I was fortunate to be part of that, where I had a lot of access to hockey. I had a lot of, competition in hockey, and still holds true today. And even though the talent base for hockey has expanded well beyond, the small conclaves of Eastern Massachusetts and Minnesota, and great players are coming from everywhere in the country. And I think that's really exciting and cool.
Absolutely. To your point about, so Bobby Orr comes to town, it galvanizes the town, hockey explodes. Not that it needed it necessarily, with the Bruins being an original six team, but certainly helped. I love the article from the Globe. It mentions your dad going to play at Jerry's Pit and the open skate area. I'd imagine, a brief organization of a blue line and a red line and calling it a hockey rink. And that was probably prevalent now all over the city for youth hockey players to go and play the game. That's great to see. You talk about the talent, obviously seeing it from all over the country now, especially for USA Hockey as a whole. Before we started recording, we were mentioning USA Hockey influence in the city of Boston alone. Right away, I think of Jack O'Callaghan, the Miracle team in 1980. Do you have connections that you grew up with USA Hockey as a whole?
Yeah, that 1980 experience was really special for those of us that were alive to understand it and appreciate it. But I was 16 years old at the time, so those guys, the Jack O'Callaghans, the Ruzionis, the Dave Silks, the Jimmy Craigs. I knew them from seeing them in the Bean Pod in the Garden and, reading about them in the Globe, but I never met them. What was cool was the subsequent Olympics, which was 1984 in Sarajevo, David A. Jensen played and as an 18-year-old, and he was affectionately on the diaper line with Patty LaFontaine and Eddie Olchek. And I grew up playing hockey with David Jensen all the way through. And the caveat is David A. Jensen was so good and so special. He was always a year and a half younger than us. David played up, 1 or 2 years. And so I played a lot of hockey games with David. And he was always, younger than me by almost 2 years, probably a year and a half. But he's always the best player on the ice. And so David A. Played in the independent school league in Massachusetts, which is really good. It's the prep school teams. He played at Belmont Hill and Lawrence Academy and came right from there. And he was drafted before he went to the Olympics, number 3 overall. If I'm correct, it might be a fact check there for you, TD.
Okay.
But he was drafted number 3 overall by Emil Cat Francis for Hartford Whalers, and then went to the Olympics and made an impact in the Olympics. The expectations were so sky high for that team. They didn't match those, but they were crazy high. But that was just a great hockey team. And I really view that time as, really the salad days or the golden era of USA hockey. And, And I was, you know, so proud to see David do what he did, because I knew what a tough, talented player he is. Yeah, went to Canada a number of times with David on hockey tournaments to St. John's, New Brunswick, and he was just a special, different player. Yeah, he was. The game was very slow for him.
I bet.
He could just dangle, and we were just all there.
It's scary to see players that just develop that speed with the puck, without the puck, where everything just slows down for them. It's lethal. And I think Nathan MacKinnon said it recently before the playoffs started in Winnipeg with the series against the Jets, and that everything right now is just slowing down for him. Which, when a guy like that says that, it's terrifying.
Yes, it really is. Yeah, it's not just the speed; it's the touch. Yeah, and then those guys just, the puck is so soft on. That's what I think about David A. Jensen, and the puck was always just so soft on his stick, and he could just flick it on net from any angle, any time, and somehow always found its way to the back of the net.
Right, right.
I would put it off the crossbar. yeah, whatever. Right? But he can always deliver. But yeah, Nathan MacKinnon, is a force. I know, that's your team, and I kind of like that cluster of pro players that are from the Maritimes. Nathan MacKinnon, Sidney Crosby, and my boy Brad Marchand. No one likes outside of Boston, but we all love Mashi. But just such a deep tradition of hockey, the Maritimes, and that's where we used to go. From Needham, a guy named Frank Bell started a youth hockey program, as a volunteer, and developed that program. And we used to send a team every year to St. John's, New Brunswick, and play in an international hockey tournament. There'd be a team from Sweden. There'd be all teams from, Canada, Moncton, Charlottetown, and would billet, people's homes. And it was really neat. So maybe that's why I'm, even though I'm not an Avs fan, I like Nathan MacKinnon.
Well, I do too. I hope he keeps going and stays healthy. You mentioned the NHL's kind of golden nemesis across all teams, Brad Marchand. So with that, let's switch gears for a little bit and talk about the NHL currently. So your team last night, the Boston Bruins, at the time of recording, they go into Toronto for the first game on the road. It's game three. They win 4-2 in a very well-fought effort. I brought a stat today that I wanted you to know about. This is credit to data-driven hockey, and they essentially have this equation where they take the expected goals against minus the actual goals against for the goaltending performances. Essentially, if the goalie is above zero, he's playing well, and if the goalie is below zero in the equation, he's not playing well. And to no one's surprise, number one on that stat is Jeremy Swayman. And it currently is looking like the best goalie in the playoffs. I think you got to ride the hot hand going into game four.
That's the million-dollar question and the tough question. And Coach Montgomery, affectionately known as Monty, we all love him. Great coach, great person. But, he's done a terrific job this playoff, calibrating the lines, switching up the power play, mixing up Brad Marchand with Pasta on different lines, and really having, two different power play looks with different players being engaged. And that's been terrific. And, committing to the every other game for goalie rotation with Linus, who's a Vezina winner, right? Yeah, has been good. Hindsight will always be 20/20, but I would say, you got to stick with Sway, especially with an extra night of rest in Toronto. The Bruins are cooling their heels, tonight, tomorrow night, for Saturday night. So fatigue should not be an issue, right? Yeah. And I think you got to ride Sway, and Sway has particularly been good against Toronto. The difficulty with that TD is once you play that card, then you're in the conundrum of flipping back and forth like Monty was last year, which didn't work out, right?
Right.
We started Linus, went Linus game two, went Linus game three, four, five, and then switched over to Sway in game seven when it was kind of too late, right? So So the trouble, so if he goes with Linus and we lose, I'm fine with that. Cause you can always, cause once you play that card of breaking that every other game rotation, then, you know, you can't take it back. But that game was terrific. Yeah. They wouldn't have won without Sway for sure. He was crazy good. Bruins' bigger problem is defensive depth. Yeah. Which historically hasn't been their issue, but yeah. Charlie McAvoy and Brendan Carlo are terrific in logging serious minutes, right? If when something happens to those guys, we'll be in trouble. But Peak, who he picked up at the deadline, looks like he's going to be out for the series, might be out for the playoffs. You know, he got hurt. That hurts in depth. Matt Grizzlick, who I love, shout out Charlestown Mass and BU. His size makes him a liability out there in playoffs because he tends to have to get penalties to box guys out, right? And he just can't, you know, hang there. And Lori, the great prospect from Ohio State, which I like a lot, which is great offensively. You know, he's too young to be out there, and he's a defensive liability. He got two penalties last night. So, you know, and then Hampus Lindholm, who's trying hard, but boy, he's really fallen off since this time last year. He was like, you know, top one or two defenseman for sure. And then, you know, didn't have a good playoffs last year against Florida. And then, you know, this season kind of same thing. So he, you know, he's solid as a four defenseman, but you know, there's not a lot of depth. You got a 1-2 with McAvoy and Carlo, and, you know, they split those guys up. And then you got Hampus, you know, as three. And then after that, it's, you know, it's a hodgepodge, right? So, you know, the Leafs know that. So they'll be sending Revo in and all those guys in to hit Charlie and Carlo anytime early and often, right? So that's going to be the bigger issue going into game four is getting these guys that they're given the opportunity as the, you know, four or five, I'm sorry, the three, or the, you know, three and four defensemen to step up, you know, that will be big. Yeah.
And
see who can do that.
Yeah. And to your point, certainly no lack of antics. It's crazy to think that Tyler Bertuzzi was just on the Bruins last playoff run last season. And now there is a clear display of a budding or already solidified rivalry between Marchand and Bertuzzi. It's crazy how fast that develops.
Well, it's whipsawed twice, TD, right? Because those guys had some issues when Bert was with Detroit. So when Bert was with Detroit and, you know, him and Marshy, and Bert came on the team and, you know, did a terrific job for the Bruins last year. I wish the Bruins found a way to keep him. But yeah, they obviously liked each other because they're on the same team and they both had a lot of value. And then this time around. So I've been proud of Marshy being the captain. He didn't take the bait games of 1 and 2. He took a lot of digs from Domi. He took a lot of digs from Bert. And I think because of that, turning the other cheek, he was able to get, you know, the no call with the refs when he tripped Bertuzzi. After Bertuzzi was trying to stir him up.
And to that, to that point, quote from the Hockey News, Sheldon Keefe post game. Quote, I don't think there's another player in the series who gets away with taking out Bertuzzi's legs the way he does. It's an art and he's elite at it. Certainly Marchand doing his job well.
Yeah, I think, you know, Coach Keith is doing what he's doing, which is working the refs. But Marshy, I could tell you this, generally doesn't get a lot of calls. He gets beat on because he's been such an instigator. The refs usually think that he started. But since Marshy turned the other cheek, game 1 and 2, he did get a call. But I get what Coach, you know, what Sheldon's doing. It's good. He's trying to, you know, work the refs. But for the start of game four, I think it's they're going to call it very closely to start. So I think both teams are going to know that you know, it's if you're a little bit chippy or throwing a dig in, like heck, Domi punched Charlie McAvoy in the back of the head twice in game two. Okay. But I don't think that stuff is going to go on in game four. So I think anything after the whistle or especially early, they're going to do that to kind of set the tempo. Otherwise, they can lose control. Yeah, lose control, and they'll be, it'll be random, and it'll be prison yard rules out there.
And what we've seen, and we touched on in episode one, is the NHL regular season this year exploded with so many different narratives. Entertainment, the value of the league has skyrocketed and teed up must watch TV with these playoff series, and it has delivered. So with that, the current state of the NHL, I think, is only trending upward in a positive direction. What are your opinions regarding where we're at with the league, and is there anything you'd like to see changed?
Yeah, Trent, as you said, I think the league is, and Gary Bettman's been in this role for a long time, right? So he's been able to really understand it and make a lot of, positive change and impact to the league. I think, one thing the league has done a very good job of is, ensuring that, the ownership groups are healthy, they're strong, that have got, an ownership, structure that can invest in the team, can invest in the community, understand that being an owner for a sports team is a, civic institution, if you will, right? Yeah.
Right.
It's not a cash flow play. Yeah. And I think he's done a great job of that. The Winter Classic, I think clamping down on, hooking and holding, and there's just been a lot of things that have been advantageous. The best of all, I think, over the past, 18 months or so is, getting the games on ESPN, getting the games on TBS, much better access. Most people aren't on the cord, right? And can sign up for an extra innings package for baseball. I mean, watching baseball was hard to find games for me that is not, online. I can stream and ESPN Plus or TBS. I get a full suite of games every night, and that wasn't always the case. I think that, changed about 2 years ago. I'm going to watch multiple hockey games tonight without having to worry about, do I have that coverage, et cetera. So a lot of things done well in hockey. The thing that they've done well on that's going to be interesting to see how it plays out is how they manage fighting. All of us that love hockey have a mixed view on fighting. Yeah, we don't want to see guys hurt. We want to see guys have PTSD. We understand it's, the gladiator in the ring is probably not a good thing to get fired up on, but it does add value, right? It polices the game. It limits, cheap shots, and it also brings a lot of excitement. It brings camaraderie to the team. It brings a lot of spectacle. It brings a lot of drama to the sport, which is great. And I think the NHL has done a nice job of legislating fighting down, not eliminating it, kind of, making it so it's more controlled and more controlled. And hopefully they can continue to do that where people are safe, but also, the excitement of that part of the game is still felt. It's a physical game. Be in a sport, and if you do something, that's cheap or dirty, you're gonna need to pay for it. You need to drop them back and go. The other thing I think they should look at, and again, I know the economics might not work, and this is subject, but make the rinks bigger. These guys are getting bigger. They're stronger. They're faster. That ice sheet is. I think the players are outgrowing that size ice sheet and really look into trying to make the ice sheet a little bigger. I know that's horror show for economics or whatever, but I think getting ahead of that might help just to continue to see the beauty of the game with the skating and the passing and the free flow. But these guys have been able to make it work. I mean, I don't know how they pass and make space. I don't know how they pass with the space they have, which is nothing. Yeah, you know that, Trent, when you're down low at a NHL hockey game, how these players are able to see and move the puck around in such a confined area is extraordinary.
I think of two examples I can cite watching hockey last night. I'm watching the Dallas Stars and the Vegas Golden Knights, game two at Dallas, and credit to Vegas's lockdown defense. Golden Knights have certainly shown up, but in the third period, Dallas, there's nowhere to move that puck. There's no, every shot's getting blocked, every pass is getting broken up. And to your point, is it their lockdown defensive strategy? Maybe. Or is it the NHL as a whole is getting bigger, faster, stronger? Yeah, probably. you made another.
And I think that goes with making the nets maybe a little bigger. Make them a, you know, half inch bigger when you do expand the rink, right? You know, people want to see goals. They want to see action. You know, come playoff time, you do love that grittiness and the neutral zone trap and blocking shots, but you also want to see that, you know, the beauty of the game of passing and shooting and, you know, that's what Bobby Orr brought to Boston way back then, right? But something to consider and think about in the future, but a lot of things done very well.
And you mentioned a lot of issues that get discussed every offseason. The ownership groups collectively sit down and go through all of these rules and potential changes, and they talk expansion and everything regarding the league we know gets discussed in the offseason. You discuss a little bit kind of your pulse on the ownership groups of the NHL, what you might know, where you think they might lean, just any insight you might have.
Yeah, well, you know, I think the ownership group is you know, really healthy. I mean, you know, the move, you know, to Salt Lake to the Hall family is obviously, you know, long time coming, and it's a difficult one, right? And it's not an easy one, but, you know, you look across the league, there's a lot of, you know, the ownership groups that are financially strong that aren't looking for cash flow. You know, the reality is most sports teams aren't generating operating profit each year. Now a lot of them lose money, right? Now the market capitalization and the value of the team goes up, right? So that's what, you know, that is certainly the benefit and a great benefit, but that benefit is not easy and it's not granted and it's not, you know, given, right? You know, it requires continued elevation of the game and growing of the product and putting a good product on the market. So I think a lot of the franchise's ownership understand that, you know, this civic responsibility. Yeah. If things go well collectively in the league and go well individually with the team, yeah, there'll be a financial benefit for the shareholders. But yeah, that's why you see some owners, which aggravates people. And I know it does with you, you know, like, you know, Foley for the Vegas Knights, right? Going over the cap, right? You know, with, you know, Mark Stone and IR and bringing in Noah Hannafin, and who's from Boston, by the way, shout out.
I'm aware.
You know, aggravates people, right? But he's, you know, he's not worried about cash flow and nickels and dimes, right? He wants to get the best team he can. And also I heard, you know, that he's made the access on local TV pretty accessible, you know, throughout that kind of Western region, you know, Nevada, so, you know, Idaho. And so he's trying to create a regional team, kind of like your Denver Broncos did, right? You know, and to do that is you provide that, you know, access on TV, like the Braves did in the Southeast for baseball. But Foley, you know, has done that, right? And Tampa Bay's obviously done that. I know the Nashville ownership group, from my brother being part of that, is really civic minded and are really thoughtful and certainly, you know, when I say thoughtful, understand the obligation or the responsibility of, yeah, having a pro franchise in a town, right? Where people count on it and you can pick up, you know, you can make a difference in people's lives on how the team plays, right? And, you know, so I think hockey's done a great job of that. And I think, you know, the Phoenix ownership structure is the last vestige of maybe things not being as tight as they should have been with, you know, the history of that ownership group. But I think what Gary did and the league did with, you know, allowing the Coyotes to be a franchise, you know, in the future, an expansion franchise in the future is smart. And it sounds like things are off to a good start in Salt Lake But like anything else, anything worthwhile is not easy, right? You got to get the stadium there, but it is a ownership group that understands their obligation to, you know, bring a community together. You know, that's what sports does. You know, you could be in a bar and, you know, you can be, you know, it's bipartisan, right? When for the case in point, your Avalanche, right? You could be in a bar with, you know, every spectrum politically, every spectrum racially, every spectrum, you name it. And everybody is together or around their team. And that's what sports do. They bring together communities. And I think the ownership consortium of the NHL understands that, and they're continuing to raise that bar.
Absolutely. And that's frankly why we started Hard Hat Hockey, was to, we saw transparent in multiple different communities across the country. There are hockey fans everywhere, and they are consistently a common denominator is they're good people, and good people gravitate towards other good people. And so we wanted a common place where people could rally and have a media outlet to go to and rely on. So in regards to your brother, I know I'm cheering on the Predators as hard as I can. They pulled off a gutsy win the other night, and he's frankly got that organization going in the right direction. Love a lot of their players. They play a hard-nosed game, and I would not want to meet them in the playoffs this year.
My brother would be the first to say that it's the organization, not him. But what's cool is my brother does bring a unique perspective, because he played college hockey at Williams, which is NESCAC conference, as we talked about earlier. And also he played pro hockey in Germany. So he's a hockey guy through and through, but they have, you know, a great tradition for, you know, being not an original six team. But, you know, I think David Poyle did a great job, and I think Barry Trotz, you know, with his, his experiences and, you know, legacy with the Predators to come back, you know, they're managing, you know, the process well for, sustainable success.
Fun, irrelevant fact. I actually ran into Barry Trotz on an elevator in Ann Arbor last year at a wedding. And he was very, very, very humble and approachable and very easy to talk to. So nothing but good things to say. Well, Matt, we really appreciate the time. You obviously are coming from a legendary hockey family. You're a pioneer for the game, a renaissance man in your own right. And Hard Hat Hockey fans are humbled to have this time and learning experience with you. Do you have anything that you want to leave us with?
No, I hope the Bruins get through and can beat the Leafs. But if the Leafs win, I'm going to be at peace with it, because, yeah, it's a great series. Boy, those first three hockey games were something, and the Leafs are really talented. And, yeah, for Willie Nylander's sake, you know, hopefully he's healthy. But, you know, if he comes back, I think my Bruins are going to be in trouble, but I'll be rooting for him.
Games like that certainly make you appreciate winning, and that's why it's so hard in the NHL. Matt, thank you again. We'll have to have you on here again, and we'd love to, stay in touch and keep talking to us about the Bruins and just hockey in general, and, you know, let us know, or let your brother know that Hard Hat Hockey's cheering for the Preds as well.
Well, I love Hard Hat Hockey, and I love the content you guys are producing, and thanks for having me on.
Yeah, Matt, that sounds good. Thank you so much. Hard Hat Hockey fans, welcome back. We hope you enjoyed the interview. To tie up today's episode, we've got a new tradition we're going to start here, the Hard Hats of the Week. Both myself and Grant are going to list our effectively three stars of the week. We're going to call it the Hard Hats of the Week, and I'll kick us off. My third star of the week is going to go to the Winnipeg Jets fans. What we've seen on national television, the outdoor parties that they're able to conduct, I'm sure that's a salty subject for Vancouver Canucks fans. We spoke to their mayor earlier. It's been a wild and ruckus environment, and their home games are electric. That whiteout is terrifying, especially when it's your team playing in their barn. So kudos to them.
My second hard hat of the week is going to Quentin Byfield in a very difficult series against a high-flying Edmonton Oilers. And 17 goals against, Quentin Byfield, like I said, is able to support a +5, which is number one in the playoffs currently in the plus-minus stat. My first hard hat of the week is going to the heroics of Jeremy Swayman, the league-leading 1.51 goals against average in a tale as old as time tradition, Boston Bruins versus the Toronto Maple Leafs. Hopefully he's able to rise above all the distractions and chippiness of the series and continue to play his game. So Grant, with that, I'll give it over to you, hard hats of the week.
Yeah, I'll go in a little different direction here. My third hard hat, I'm not sure how to like word this. Apparently the Dallas Stars have a cannon. So if you know anything about the Blue Jackets, it's kind of like our trademark, it's our alternative logo, goes off at the beginning of the game, goes off when we score. I'm not saying that the Jackets are the only team allowed to have a cannon, but I'm curious of what Dallas is, because like the Jackets thing is like the Civil War branding in Ohio's history of like the Union Army. You know, Dallas isn't San Antonio. It's not an Alamo thing. But I'll give them a third hard hat for trying to drum up some culture and some playoff vibes in the arena. Dallas is a little sterile. It's a lot of guys running up credit card debt to look flashy. So I get where they're trying to maybe astroturf some hockey culture down there. My second hard hat is for Chris Kreider of the New York Rangers. Every time he scores a goal, he looks like he like hates scoring. He just starts screaming and banging his head against the glass. I kind of like that, like a little showmanship. And then my number one is Quinn Hughes, just because I love that little guy so much. I'm rooting for the Vancouver Canucks. Put my journalistic bias aside, I just think he's a great player. We kind of mentioned this. It's hard to watch hockey, or sometimes it's hard to watch the Canadian teams in the States, especially way out there in the Pacific Northwest. So I really like being able to watch him come playoff time.
All right, hard hockey fans, the first of its kind, the hard hats of the week. We want to hear from you. Chime in. Let us know what you think about our picks. Let us know what you think about hard hats of the week. Who are your hard hats of the week? We can't wait to hear from you. Enjoy all the playoff matchups moving forward. We got a whole weekend of must-watch television. Reach out. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you soon. See y'all.